Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
So the 2018 FIFA World Cup, ladies and gentlemen, will be organized in Russia.
Hi, and welcome to the Political Football, the World Cup series from These Football Times. After four series looking around the world and back through time to examine how football and politics seem to be inevitably and inextricably knitted together as part of the social fabric of life, we've taken a different tack with Series 5. We've been devoting each episode in this series to a particular World Cup tournament ranging from 1930 up to and including the scheduled 2022 event in Qatar. In the company of a number of typically brilliant and knowledgeable guests, we've looked in depth at each tournament, considering the wider political situation at the time, how and why politics were involved in the awarding of the tournament, and any issues regarding location. Plus, of course, the movers and shakers at the heart of these things. With regard to the tournament in particular, we've also looked at any political aspects involving players, teams, managers, and key rivalries. It's a new slant on the political football theme, and one we hope you've enjoyed. It's offered some fascinating discussions, and we've enjoyed them, so we just hope you have too. We're up to 2018 and the first World Cup to be held in Eastern Europe as the tournament travelled to Russia. As ever, sitting in the co-host seat alongside me is my political football comrade-in-arms, Stu Horsfield. How are you doing, Stu?
Hey, Gary, you okay?
Yeah, good, thanks, matey. We're back in the political football saddle, and we've got a nice glass of Tempranillo. So we're having a nice chat about football and looking at the really recent World Cup, mate.
Excellent. I've got the usual Diet Coke. Obviously, we're not sponsored by Coca-Cola or anything, but that's the usual tipple that I turn up with.
Yeah. Other soft drinks are available.
Oh, yes, they are. Other brands of cola also available.
So who's our guest today, mate?
Guests today, we're joined by Matthew Gibbs. Matt's 27-year-old journalist living and working in Madrid, frequent contributor to These Football Times for the website, and we're here with the podcast. Also writes for other publications such as No Place Like Home and The Football Pink as well.
How you doing, Matthew?
Hi, not too bad, guys. Thanks for having me on. Looking forward to getting stuck into this one.
Good, man. That's what we like to hear. Ready and keen, ready to roll. So, okay, so let's get the ball out and have a kick around. So why this tournament, Matthew? What particularly interests you about the politics in this one?
So, I think this is a fascinating tournament. It's one that exists slap bang in the middle of the information age. It's the story of the 2018 World Cup is one that spans decades, and it's the story of FIFA and how that organisation is laughably corrupt. And it may be a little bit harsh to say now, but I think it's also the tournament that made hypocrites of us all for watching it.
Well, Stu, this sounds like one for us, mate, doesn't it?
I was going to say, yeah, what a great opening that is.
Great opening. So just pick up one of those lines you mentioned there, Matthew. You said hypocrites. Why so, mate?
So this simply comes down, in my opinion, to because everyone knew. This isn't like in 78 in Argentina, where you could maybe argue there was a degree of separation between football and politics. Tell me if I'm wrong, but people in the 70s, like, it was possible to remain unaware or maybe a bit oblivious of the goings on around the world. But now we have social media, now we have smartphones, now we know everything that happens in the world, and especially in Russia. This is Russia who invades other sovereign states, who sponsors the gassing of Syrian children, assassinates people on British soil, and in their own country they jail journalists and political opponents or do worse. They hold elections that serve only to solidify their leader, who is effectively a dictator, and to throw a blanket over the whole thing They hold elaborate and expensive sporting events like Sochi in 2014 and this Russia 2018 tournament. I mean, okay. Yeah, Russia have been linked to multiple cyber attacks, the discovery of interference in foreign elections. The list is endless. FIFA politicizes the World Cup by allowing regimes such as Russia to host it. And we all knew why Putin and Russia wanted to host the World Cup is to help improve his and the country's image. I say hypocrites, which I include me myself in it because I watched and enjoyed it. But the only action we have as ordinary folk is to not watch it. And we all knew, but we still watched it.
Sure. I mean, great opening. Stu, first thoughts?
It makes me look at myself a little bit. It's like you say, I think what you're saying here, Matt, and I think it's fascinating. It's going to be something that comes up, I'm assuming, sort of throughout this episode. And like you say about the, you know, about the information technology, social media, I mean, this, you know, this really is the first truly global World Cup. I know that sounds really difficult, quite silly, because it's, you know, it's a global tournament, but actually this is a tournament that is at everyone's fingertips. It's on everybody's screens, it's on their watches, it's on their phones, it's, you know, it sort of permeated practically every single household and probably every room in every single household, should you sort of allow it in. And I think, you know, that probably puts it under the microscope more than any other football tournament that there's ever been.
I totally agree, 100%. And it's like I say, we're in the middle of the information age, where whatever you want, you can get at the click of a button. We have these incredible smartphones, these little boxes that tell us everything we want to know. We can watch the World Cup, and we can see, like during the final when Pussy Riot ran onto the pitch, in seconds we can find out who they are, what they wanted, what they were protesting for. And so it means every little action, everything that happens or doesn't happen, is there's a hyper focus on it. And it's like you say, it's impossible to look at this tournament as anything other than sort of the social media tournament, as the, like, it's under the microscope.
Can I ask another question? I'm really sorry, Gary.
I'm sorry, mate. Go for it.
So just a question then, Matt. You know, just sort of to begin with, do you think the World Cup and the viewing experience is better or worse for that?
That's a difficult one to say, because I'm under the age of 30, so all the sort of the World Cups I've ever watched have generally been, all the World Cups I've ever watched and generally been involved with have all been sort of related to, you know, watching them all on TV and then being able to go on the internet afterwards and find out information or during. So I don't know. It's a difficult one to answer. It's a difficult one to answer.
What about you, Gary? I mean, obviously you and I can remember World Cups, you know, before the social media age, if you like. And, you know, I was just wondering, you know, what your thoughts are of a World Cup, like Matt said, everything at your fingertips instantly, or a World Cup that just washes over you and then seems to be just gone again.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. I mean, you know, every I think without exception, we've had probably seven or eight actually, I think, tournaments we've covered so far. And each of the guys we've had on talking about a particular tournament have said that World Cup is the most political. And there's a good argument to be made, and Matthew started off already making the argument that this could be, you know, also be the most political. But I think what it is the most instantly understandable, instantly accessible, no holds barred. You haven't got to wait 24 hours, it's fingertips, it's there, it's digital. And I think that makes a massive difference to the not to the reality, but to the perception of it. I don't think do you, is that how you'd see it, Matthew?
The perception, yeah, for sure. It's definitely interesting. I mean, if I think in terms of just social media, it's one of those ones where, like, this tournament takes place, and throughout the entire thing, you can go on Twitter, you can see, like, pictures of, like, an incredible piece of skill by Pogba, an amazing goal, some controversy. Then next to that, it has people saying, how can you watch this? This is taking place in a country that, you know, tortures LGBTQ people every single day. And by watching it, it means you're effectively condoning it. It's everything is side by side and close together, and it's impossible to disengage them. Yeah. I would say
it's interesting when you say about watching it, and watching it equals condoning it. And I'm not saying you're saying that. I know that some people have said that, but I suppose, you know, the counter argument is, does not watching it make any difference? I mean, you know, we've discussed, as I mentioned earlier, different World Cup tournaments throughout the ages, and Argentina with the military dictatorship. The World Cup held in Italy before the Second World War, the second tournament, 1934, dominated by Mussolini and the fascist state. And so this is nothing new. It's nothing new. So is it just that it's a case that it's more noticeable because it's the world is becoming a more accessible place for everybody just to see things, and so there's less reason to hide our heads under the pillow?
Yes, I think so. And I think I think we are, today we're offered more of a choice than maybe people were back in the 1930s. I mean, who would have watched the World Cup back in the 1930s? Really, it's just people in Italy, I guess. But now you kind of have a choice to actively engage with this entity that got the World Cup by corrupt methods and takes place in a country that is so far and beyond corrupt that you can possibly imagine. And it comes down to a choice. Like, do you want to engage with it or don't you? And I think that's the kind of thing that I wrestled with before, during and after. And what makes the World Cup so interesting, this particular World Cup so interesting, because it's just so openly and brazenly politicized by FIFA, by Russia, and yeah, you have to make that choice, and it's a difficult choice, and one that, I mean, as much as I say we're all hypocrites for watching it, I watched it, I loved it. It's one of my favorite World Cups in football in terms ever. Like, that England run to the semi-final was incredible and memorable, but still made a choice that, you know, I doubt myself, and afterwards I was like, maybe I shouldn't have been involved in that, I shouldn't have engaged with it, as someone who considers myself quite political. It's a difficult one. Yeah, I think you're saying that a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting that you sort of, you know, you're almost sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Doubting your own integrity because you've watched it. But, you know, as I said, would it have made any difference not to watch it? And I suppose the short answer is no. But there again, that's not why people should or should not make a political stance. Just give us a little bit of a wider political view of the situation at the time before the World Cup, and, you know, why Russia was deemed to be so much an international pariah.
So I've got a bit of a sort of mini timeline here. So the 2018 World Cup took place 4 years after the annexation of Crimea from Ukraine by Russia, an act of aggression considered to be an act of war by the international community, but it's still something that is ongoing and largely unpunished by the world. Took place four years after the Sochi Winter Olympics and the much publicised human rights and LGBTQ protests that took place there, which is something that sort of fueled a lot of the opposition against Russia hosting the World Cup. In 2015, there was the FIFA corruption scandal, which we will get into shortly. In 2017, there were anti-gay purges in Chechnya, which isn't exactly Russia, but it's a sort of Republic of Russia. And it's something that has largely gone unpunished and largely untalked about in the world. Also in 2018, there was the Skripal poisoning the Skripal poisoning in Salisbury, which led to no British political representation at the World Cup itself. And then also there's a lot of racism in Russia, and the associated dissolution of the anti-racism task force by FIFA, which was bizarre. Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 was shut down by pro-Russian forces while flying over Ukraine. And there's also the curious case of Chinese investment into property owned by FIFA and the Russian doping scandal that is still having repercussions around the world. This mini timeline shows the World Cup for what it is, the most obvious example of sports washing that's probably been in modern times. Because he was led by Putin at a time when his popularity in Russia was a bit shaky, and it helped transform Russia into the autocratic state we now know and love. There's been a lot made of how important this World Cup was to Putin.
Yeah, I think you put love in inverted commas there, didn't you, mate?
I did. There's going to be a lot of inverted commas during this.
Yeah, there's that's a pretty long indictment list, and we'll examine a few of those. So, thoughts, Stu?
This is one of those. This is going to be an episode where, you know, like we said, it was chosen for a reason. There was obviously political inference, but it's the breaking down of all the political inferences that you sort of. Well, obviously, people who are listening will have their opinions, but certainly sat here now recording it, I'm just shaking my head in sort of disbelief that how did this ever come to pass? How did it come to be? You know, as Matt's explained there, you know, as an example of sports washing, but ultimately, you know, when things like that are, you know, are reeled off one after the other after the other after the other, and it really does make you catch your breath and just be almost aghast at. And I don't know why, because we're on about episode 8 or 9 of these now, and each one of them I've thought, I don't know how I'm going to get away with this. I don't know how this World Cup ever came to pass. And yet it almost seems that, be it FIFA, host nations, ruling parties of host nations, it just seems, in football just seems to pervade everything. It's all right. It can just overcome anything that is sort of almost put in its way. It's just... Listening to that list there, it's just incredible. Looking back, when it's all compiled together, how this tournament ever came to pass.
I totally agree with what you say. It's like any one of those issues would be something that would make people say, "Are you sure about this? Should we really be giving this regime the World Cup?" But when you put them all in a big list, and I think it really highlights how much, you know, looking in the other direction, politically speaking, a lot of governments around the world have done when it comes to some of these issues.
Yeah, just going to jump on one of the things you mentioned about the Skripal poisoning and British government reaction was to send no political representation to the World Cup. I mean, are you having a giraffe? I mean, I'm sure Putin was shaking in his socks about that. And I'm being a bit facetious here, but you know, it just shows how absolutely pointless these gestures can be when you say, okay, we're not going to send any political representation. I mean, that's not going to be Putin at all. And you know, it's almost like for domestic consumption. Well, we're standing up to the Russians, but it doesn't mean anything, does it really? And a bit like you mentioned about the annexation of Crimea and an act of war, which it was, because it's an invasion of a sovereign territory, and the world did a big fat sod all about it. And all it does is it just encourages these despotic regimes, and let you know, without sort of, you know, putting too fancy a name on it, to carry on.
Basically, yeah, it's essentially looking the other way. They didn't exactly come out and say, well, what happened was okay, but you know, if you look the other way, it's kind of allowing it. All that effectively happened when it came to the annexation of Crimea in terms of international reaction was condemnation, nothing else.
Yeah.
Not that I know enough about the subject to know what could else have been done, but it's just, yeah, I mean, when it was, what, six years ago since it happened, and on the anniversary, again, Britain reiterated this wasn't okay, but nothing else happens. Yeah, but yeah. I think that's the sort of common theme with this World Cup, is that there's a lot of words and a lot of bluster, but not a lot of actions, and Russia still continue, bizarrely, to carry on as hosts, it's laughable. The whole situation, when it's like we put that long list together, it gets to a point where you have to laugh, because it's baffling.
Yeah, you absolutely do, because if you don't laugh, you'll cry. And you know, as you say, you know, it's a shake in the head and going, tut tut, that's not really very nice, is it? And that's pretty well it. Yes, Stu?
Yeah, it's funny, you know, like I say, do you think that the list is, you know, and we talk about this list that you've sort of generated for us, Matt, do you think that the list has become so... there's so much to it that, you know, there's so many examples, so many irrefutable claims, that ultimately the world has just gone, look, do you know what, it, all of this has happened and we're still going ahead with it. So therefore, you know, it's almost, you know, any sort of action is almost paralyzed just by the sheer weight of and volume of sort of information that should go against it and that should stop it, that it actually has a counter effect and actually just allows everything to go ahead because there is just too much. There's just too much weight behind why it shouldn't, that it can't be sort of sifted through and pinpointed. So people have just held their hands up and gone, do you know what? If any of these things aren't going to prevent this tournament from happening, let's just go with it.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of fear involved as well, because the repercussions of doing more, like, so when it comes to the Crimea, the Crimea incident, like, what more can they do in a way? Because what are you going to declare war on Russia? What then? Who goes to war with each other, and how does that affect international relations when we know that Russia is so tied up in certain, well, sorry, we don't know, allegedly Russia is so tied up in issues in America, for example. What then? I think the sort of the fear of what might happen next sort of, like you say, paralyzes governments and paralyzes any action, which means that nothing happens and everything just carries on as normal.
Yeah, I guess, you know, what you're saying, well, I think what you're saying is, I'm not trying to put word in your mouth, but it's sort of confirm or deny. So is the footballing world offering Russia some kind of free pass on this? So, you know, are they allowing them to do the sports washing without revealing their dirty laundry?
100% yes, basically, is exactly what it is. It's like we in the news right now is the potential Saudi takeover of Newcastle, and this is exactly what that was. This is just sports washing. It's a way of using massive sporting events, and the World Cup is bigger than any other sporting event. Totally eclipses anything that happens within that country. That people forget about everything. They know the power of football. They know the power of what can be achieved by hosting this tournament. And that's what Putin wanted. Putin knew how important it was, knew how huge it was and what it could mean for Russia. And this came, if I can find it exactly, but this came after a decade of sort of good economic growth for Russia, thanks largely to record prices for oil and other natural resources. Putin wanted Russia to be a superpower again, and winning the right to host the World Cup when it's watched by millions of people around the world would be an amazing way of, you know, showing Russia is strong and stable, to quote Theresa May. And almost most importantly, it helps like boost Putin's image among Russian people. It's a way of like, There's a really fascinating article in the Blizzard about Scotland at the 1978 World Cup, I think, and how that campaign was so disastrous for Scotland that it sort of crushed any nationalism in the country at the time. And there was talk of a potential separation vote from the UK. Didn't happen because of how bad this performance was at the World Cup. There's like a long history of how successful the World Cup and how successful you know, Russia taking part in the World Cup, how successful they could be and how that reflects on the government. Yeah. Putin knew this.
Yeah. Any further thoughts on this, Stu, before we move on to the board of the tournament?
Like I said, I mean, you know, it comes back to, you know, and I feel like I ask this question on every episode. And I suppose it's, you know, again, Matt, your perspective, your opinion on FIFA as a ruling governing body, and if there was ever, you know, are you aware of, or, you know, do you think that maybe there was a point where FIFA could or should have maybe stepped in and looked at redistributing the hosting rights for this tournament?
Yes, but also no at the same time, because when we get into the whole FIFA scandal of 2015, we sort of understand that while they maybe could have had the opportunity to do it, they were never going to, because there was too much money involved, too many deals involved, the bribery and racketeering that was involved in hosting this World Cup in Russia meant that it didn't matter what happened, they were never ever going to deviate from the original plan. Russia was always going to host this World Cup.
Yeah. Just before we move on to the awarding of the tournament and location, that sort of thing, just want to touch on the LGBT issue that you mentioned earlier. and the aspects of that with regard to the World Cup and how people should perceive the tolerance, stroke intolerance that was exhibited there.
Yeah, so for me, this is the biggest cross against Russia when it comes to them hosting the finals. Their record of how they treat the LGBTQ community is abysmal and nothing short of grotesque. And I mean, football already has a shaky relationship with LGBT issues. In Britain, in England, you have to go down to the eighth level of English football to find the first openly gay football person, not even player. He's a manager who manages Ashworth Town. His name is Luke Tufts. And that is a pretty shameful reflection on football in Britain. Yes, we have Rainbow Laces that does a lot of good in spreading the message of acceptance, but the fact that no high-profile footballer has come out publicly is kind of awful and says a lot about how they know how they would be treated by the press, by their colleagues, by fans in the stadium. Russia takes it to a whole other level of horrifying. This is all allegedly what happens now in the country, but apparently gay men are allegedly kidnapped, tortured and murdered on a daily basis. There are numerous reports of gay torture camps in the Republic of Chechnya, where parents are reportedly summoned to execute their children. Local governments go as far to claim that gay people don't exist. Chechnya itself is an extreme example of the wider culture of homophobia in Russia. And this is a country where federal law was passed saying that gay propaganda, in inverted commas again, is not allowed. You're not allowed to promote same-sex relationships. And then at this World Cup, at the opening game, Vladimir Putin is sat next to Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. And this is FIFA putting together the two most oppressive regimes for LGBTQ people at the centre of the biggest footballing show in the world. And this sort of ties in what we said before. This isn't being tolerant or accepting of the LGBTQ community. This is practically promoting anti-gay and homophobic sentiments. During the World Cup, apparently players were sent rainbow laces to wear to help promote inclusivity in the sport, where 4 in 10 people who are from the LGBT community don't feel welcome. But no players wore anything and no delegates wore any badges either. The British government went as far to advise gay football fans going to the tournament to publicly hide their sexuality in case anything happened. And this is just the biggest problem when it comes to giving a tournament to a regime like Russia. It's like we said, it's huge. It eclipses everything. So for a month, the world forgets that this is a country that tortures and murders their LGBTQ citizens every day. And all the work that institutions like Stonewall do is swept aside and told it's unimportant. So I personally can't imagine how it would feel to be someone from the LGBTQ community watching this and seeing that it's almost like you're told that what your fears that you live with every day are unimportant. It's what I find the most depressing aspect about this World Cup. It saddens me.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. You know, when you say LGBT community, we're just talking people.
Yeah, exactly.
They're just people. I agree entirely. And, you know, I'm not sure anybody, any reasonable person listening would also agree with you, Matthew. So we should move on to the issues awarding the tournament and the location. So given what you've said and the political background, both of the zeitgeist and also the way that Russia presents itself to the world, how did they get the tournament?
Woof. So this is a long, convoluted and complicated story that I don't think sport has ever seen anything like it. The best place to begin is in 2007, where FIFA abolished its process of rotating World Cups between confederations. Think of the 2006 World Cup being held in Germany, UEFA, and the previous one being held in South Korea and Japan, the Asian Football Confederation. At the same time, they also announced that the 2018 and 2022 World Cups would be bid for simultaneously and announced at the same time. From there, it was just pure lobbying by the competing nations in an effort to convince the 24-person executive committee, also known as EXCO, that their country was the right one to host. Now, EXCO is made up of household names. Sepp Blatter, for example, Michel Platini, Franz Beckenbauer, and other new names that we'll talk about, such as Chuck Blazer, Mohammed bin Hammam, and Jack Warner. Now, Jack Warner is a very interesting character who sort of perfectly encapsulates the absurdness and corruption of the story. He was born in Trinidad and rose from relative poverty to become the third ranking vice president of FIFA, the longest serving member of Exco at this time. He represents CONCACAF, who they don't house many of the footballing powers, but in political terms, they're giants in football. And this is because Warner rules with an iron fist at this time. Every member of CONCACAF has to vote exactly how he dictates. He was somebody who would, he was very free with his money, shall we say. And if people, if the nation's voting didn't do exactly what he said, they wouldn't receive any money. So at this point, winning the right to host is about more than just quality of stadiums, airports, football in the country. All the bidding parties knew that if they wanted to host the World Cup, they would have to lobby these Exco members and especially Jack Warner. Examples of this include Qatar building new Aspire academies in countries that had FIFA Exco members. The Russian bid was caught giving very expensive artwork to Exco members. And England, just as guilty of racketeering as everyone else, were found to be giving out Mulberry handbags to the wives of Exco members. It went further than this, though. Exco members knew the power they had and they knew the power they wielded. So they made brazen requests for what are essentially bribes. Warner, for example, demanded from the English delegation that one of his family be employed in English football. So in an attempt to get ahead of the competition, England decided to hire a spy, just to make this story go even more absurd. They hired an intelligence officer, Christopher Steele, who began investigating the other bids. He started hearing rumours about what Russia were doing behind closed doors. He collected a big pile of intelligence that suggested Russian government officials and oligarchs close to Putin had been enlisted to push the effort. The list of what happened behind closed doors is astonishing. It was clear that Russia were investing more than anyone else in this process. According to Bonita Mercedes, who worked on the Australian bid and attended the Zurich 2010 vote, she said that all the bids had hired their own spies, but it was really noticeable when the Russians turned up because nobody could hear or see anything because the Russians had jammed everyone else's devices. Everyone was using spies. Everyone was bribing someone. Everybody was involved in some sort of illegal activity. When the vote finally came around in Zurich in 2010, the city was full of celebrities and spies. England sent David Cameron, Prince William and David Beckham. Australia sent Elle Macpherson, and the billionaire chairman of its soccer federation, Frank Lowy. The US sent Landon Donovan, Morgan Freeman and Bill Clinton. But all to no avail, as on the 2nd of December 2010, Russia were awarded the World Cup and the fallout was huge. FIFA, are brazenly, openly, almost cartoonishly corrupt. And this vote is what outed them publicly to the world.
Wow. Thoughts, Duke?
This episode probably, like I say, every time we have this, we're like, this must be the most political World Cup, blah, blah, blah. But sort of listening to Matt there, and it is one of those things you follow. And I can remember the announcing of the winners. You know, I can remember Cameron and Beckham, you know, going and Prince William, you know, going, waiting for the announcements. And it's one of those where this sort of, whether it's me and I didn't pay enough attention back then, or whether I don't pay attention to the here and now and tend to look back at things retrospectively. But at the time, you know, there was rumours, there was murmurings, you know, and certainly as Matt said there, as soon as the results were announced, it was incredibly questionable, the two sort of winning bids. But I can't comprehend how all of this had a lid kept on it, whereby the entire process could go from start to finish without there being some sort of, you know, either investigation, repercussion, or halt to the proceedings. I cannot for the life of me comprehend how this ever had a start and played out to its ultimate end.
This is the thing. I don't know if exactly if it was hidden, because a lot of the stuff that happened behind closed doors, but they didn't hide this. I mean, Sepp Blatter, I don't even know where to begin with him. Like, his entire history of being president of FIFA has just been one weird comment and one problematic comment after another. I mean, just I don't know if you guys ever, there's a, I did watch this the other day, but there's an interview of him talking about the money that FIFA has. And it's an Al Jazeera journalist, and he asked Sepp Blatter about this money, and Sepp Blatter's like, we don't have that. We're a non-profit organisation. And he's like, but you have $1 billion reserve of money. And he's like, yeah, it's a reserve. And it's just, it was there the entire time. I think it's baffling. And I'm the same as you. I don't understand how FIFA as an organisation has ever been allowed to exist.
It's interesting with regard to the granting of Russia for the tournament. And I'm not naive enough to think it was true, but apparently what was posited as the convincing argument for the Russian for Russia to get the tournament was a map of Europe which showed that in Western Europe, tournament had been held in England, France twice, Spain, Germany twice, Italy twice, and not a single time in Eastern Europe. So there was, I suppose, what's the word I'm looking for? I hesitate to use the word moral in this sort of connotation, but it was almost a sort of moral obligation to allow it to be going into Eastern Europe at some stage. And, you know, I'm not sort of naive enough to say that was the real reason, you know, and you make perfectly reasonable, valid points about the inducements that were offered. But should it have gone to Eastern Europe anyway?
Possibly. I mean, it's a fair point you make. I mean, the whole point of the World Cup is that, and especially the rotation of the confederations, mean that they take the World Cup to places that where it hasn't happened before. And, you know, think of Japan and South Korea, think of South Africa. It's all about, expanding it, taking football everywhere. Whether Russia is the answer, I don't know. I don't think so, because... I mean, as I think we'll touch on later, that everything down to the stadiums and the infrastructure just wasn't there for this to happen. But yeah, I don't have a straight answer for that one, I'm afraid. But
no.
I do agree with what you say. I don't think Russia was the answer.
Yeah, it's just a plaster that's sort of convenient to put on the open wound, shall we say?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, Stu.
Yeah, like I say, it's. It just seems, you know, FIFA as a corrupt organisation, and I think you know we can trace this back, you know, to the time of Havelange, and you know, Sepp Blatter is a protege of Havelange. Havelange, you know, absolutely ruled FIFA with an iron fist in it. And I suppose this is what happens when something goes so unchecked for so long that. You almost the world almost becomes powerless to stop it. That power, that autonomy, has been allowed to grow and develop from essentially from 1974 up until today. It's you know, we've had discussions before whereby, you know, even US presidents are, you know, get two terms and that's it. Havelange was there from 74 to 98. You know, Blatter's there from 98 to 2016, I think. You know, you've almost got nearly half a century where only two people have overseen arguably the most powerful sports organization in the world. It was always going to have this inflated sense of almost being untouchable because that's how it had been allowed to develop and manifest itself.
And exactly, and there's a reason for that, though. There is a reason why things never change. It's because the money involved, and it always comes back down to money, is. So the way FIFA is set up is that every country in FIFA, every nation, sorry, gets the same amount of money. So USA will get the same amount of money as Montserrat. And Montserrat isn't even, I think, it's not a recognised country by the UN. I might be wrong, but they are a nation with about 6,000 people. But the money that is passed down from FIFA to its members is exactly the same. So it's in their interest to make sure it stays exactly the same. It's kind of why CONCACAF it becomes such a force in political terms within FIFA, because like they and Jack Warner, that it was in their interest to make sure nothing ever changed.
Yeah, I guess it's less to do. Well, no, it's not less to do. It has much to do with the money they get, that the fact that Montserrat has exactly the same number of votes as Spain and or Italy and or England and or Germany and or any other. Established country, and this is why people can sort of swing massive amounts of power because by courting votes and offering inducements for that. I just sort of one quick question, and this is an impossible question, so I'm going to try and do a stew here and give you an impossible question. So, was the awarding of this tournament any more corrupt than the awarding of any other tournament in the World Cup in recent years?
This is hard to say, because FIFA and corruption go together like the Pope and Catholicism. They are just intertwined and difficult to separate. But this is something that went back decades. And I think there is an element of, I'm not sure this is the right word, but an element of escalation. Like, everything gets bigger, everything gets scarier, everything gets more corrupt. And the amounts of money involved in the bribery and racketeering deals behind the scenes are eye-watering when it comes to this tournament. I don't know, it's difficult to say whether this tournament is more corrupt than any others. I mean, like you say, Havelange back in the 70s sort of began all this, didn't he? He began the culture of corruption within FIFA. But this is the tournament that highlighted that and showed the corruption at the heart of FIFA that everyone knew existed, but he was the proof.
Yeah. Stu?
Yeah, part of me, and I apologise, is fascinated by FIFA, by Havelange, by Blatter, by its politics. You know, Jack Warner, Chuck Blazer, Platini. You know, all this cast of characters. If it wasn't actually true, it would make for a great film. You know, it's a story that absolutely fascinates me. It's a story that gives far more questions than it does answers, and it's just the most incredible story that has been allowed. You know, and as Matt said, it's almost out in the open. It's brazen. It's there. It's in the public domain, and yet still, you know, presidents and political rulers have lost power for far less, and yet here is this, like I said, this football organization. Like Matt said, you know, a lot of this, and it does come down to money. He's absolutely right, but yet somehow this singular organization has been allowed to operate unchecked for decades. And even now, with all this irrefutable evidence in front of us, and you know, Infantino's in place at the moment, but I personally still have absolutely zero faith in FIFA, absolutely zero faith. But like I say, it's the story of an organisation that, if it wasn't true, would make for a great film. But sadly, it is true.
You're absolutely right, and the hilarious part of all this as well is just. I'm guessing you guys have, but have you ever seen the HQ, FIFA's HQ in Zurich? Yeah. It's almost a carbon copy of the war room from Dr. Strangelove. Even no matter what they do, it's just cartoonish. It's the best way I can think about it. It's like you said, they exist in this weird grey area where they're not a business, they're not a governmental organisation, they're not a conventional non-profit organisation. They don't pay taxes. They force countries that host the World Cup to change laws and just leave a trail of destruction in their wake, while the money just keeps coming in for them, but the host country gets none of the profits. I honestly struggle to comprehend how a corporation like FIFA has been allowed to exist.
Yeah. I'd really sort of sort of get the ball out, as they say, and sort of kick around a bit. We've sort of looked at different World Cup tournaments over the years, and political elites that were governing country at the time, Argentina, with the military hunter there, and they won the World Cup. And Russia did, by general acclamation, the better than was expected, which was probably a bonus for Putin. Do you think it would have been, was it a gamble? Was it a gamble by him if Russia had tanked and, I don't know, got eliminated? Lost every game. Would it have harmed Putin, do you think? So what's the relationship between the benefit to the government and the success and or failure of the national team?
Well, this is something, like I mentioned before, about the Scotland in the 78 World Cup, where The performance was so catastrophic that it just any nationalism was sucked out of the country. It's the exact same sort of thing here. Putin is fully aware that if the team performs well, and they did, Russia were excellent in this World Cup, then it has a knock-on effect to the happiness of the public, and by association the faith that the public have in Putin. It's difficult to play the what if game in like what would have happened if it had gone badly for Russia in this World Cup, because I'm sure Putin would have had a plan B and another way of solidifying his power, but it couldn't have gone more perfectly for him. It was a perfect World Cup for them.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Stu?
Yeah, it's funny, you know, your point there, we've done a lot of these episodes and it sort of, to me, it makes me think back to sort of Brazil, 1970, and, you know, the military dictatorship there, and, you know, obviously Putin isn't, in inverted commas, running a military dictatorship, but in terms of, you know, we've discussed it before, Gary, you know, football, you know, if a nation is doing well in the game of football, sadly, it can hide an awful lot about what's going on at home. And certainly politicians are very quick to use national football teams, you know, as a tool for propaganda or as a tool for distraction and deception with regards to what's actually happening in the country. And, you know, and again, it's, you know, Stephen talks about this a lot. You know, history has a way of repeating itself, and, you know, sort of listening there to, and obviously, you know, Russia were never going to be Brazil in the 1970. However, the performances of Russia and the performances of Brazil in 1970, you know, the way that could be used then by ruling authorities is exactly the same. And they're, you know, they're nearly 50 years apart, and yet nothing has changed. Nothing in the way the game's used, nothing in the way politicians use the game for their own personal gain and political gain. I really struggle, and probably in this episode more than any other, I really struggle to, now I sit and listen, and certainly listen to Matt, I really struggle how this has been allowed to happen. These conversations would have been happening 50 years ago, and here we are still having exactly the same discussion, same game, same tournament, same problems.
I absolutely agree. It's the element of it all that I find maybe the most depressing. Nothing changes. When we read out the list earlier of the indictments of Russia, and nothing changes. They were just allowed to carry on and host, and that's why FIFA, as much as I think we'll touch on it now, the aftermath of what happened in 2015 with the scandal. Half of the exco of that exco committee I mentioned have been banned or arrested. They're no longer in football, but I don't see how it's any better, because, you know, you get rid of one corrupt official, another one takes the place. So nothing changes, and that's the most depressing part.
Yeah, it's true. It's like, here's a new boss, same as the old boss. Yeah, but I want to talk about some of the games, but before that, I'm intrigued by Mr. Steel, James Bond 007. License to Kick the Ball, and Chuck Blazer. Can you tell us a little bit more about those?
Yeah, he's an interesting character. So Christopher Steele's a former MI6 intelligence officer, in other words, a spy. He had spent several years undercover in Moscow in the early 1990s, then left to set up a more senior post on the Russian desk still in MI6 headquarters in London. He's also the individual who wrote the dossier about Donald Trump's connections with Putin and Russia. He is integral to this story. He, in 2010, when sources began reporting that Putin was a lot more interested in the World Cup bid than he initially was. In April of that year, the Russian Deputy Prime Minister, I'm going to say this wrong, but Igor Sechin, went to Qatar to discuss a natural gas extraction project. The same month, Russia, the Russian World Cup bid team, also travelled to Qatar. And according to Steele, this timing wasn't a coincidence, because along with these enormous gas deals, the emissaries were colluding to swap World Cup boats. Steele's findings found that England's bid was doomed. But more importantly, he was fully aware of the magnitude of what he had and knew who would be able to use it, the FBI, which is where another one of the major players comes in, Chuck Blazer. Chuck Blazer. So after all these years of corruption, and after the vote in 2010, there were howls of corruption from everywhere. I mean, the English bid used their parliamentary power to make their concerns clear in a political setting. So FIFA hired a guy called Michael J. Garcia to investigate and publish a report about it. This wasn't published until 2017 because it was blocked by the adjudicatory arm of FIFA's ethics committee. This also saw Garcia resign out of protest. The German newspaper Bild got a copy, basically forcing FIFA's hand to publish it. It found that there were no instances of corruption in the Russian or Qatar bid, but there were in the English bid. And alongside this, simultaneously, the FBI had been tipped off about Chuck Blazer, who hadn't submitted a tax return for years, despite the fact he's an immensely wealthy man. So wealthy, he has an apartment in Trump Tower just for his cats. This is the level of richness we're talking about. He's absurdly rich. He became, after the FBI was given the information by Steele, he became an FBI informant for them. And this is where, when I mentioned that, this is a story that spans decades, because he found or told the FBI that the 2010 World Cup, the FIFA Exco committees accepted bribes in connection with South Africa as the host. In 1998, one of his co-conspirators received a bribe from Morocco to host the tournament, even though it was eventually awarded to France. And then he also accepted bribes in connection with broadcast rights for the CONCACAF Gold Cup tournament in 96, 98, 2000, 2002, and 2003. What also came to the surface is that those involved in this criminal activities, the amount involved was well over 132 million in bribes and kickbacks. And I think, I'm sure you guys remember, this is when the scandal erupted in like the most public way possible with the raid on the hotel in Zurich, where seven FIFA executives were arrested. And then in the following months, another 30 FIFA exco members were arrested, charged and indicted, while other high profile figures like Sepp Blatter and Michel Platini have all been banned from football. And this is all down to basically just to steal. Yeah. Curiously, I think what the interesting part about this is that what Steele was doing, I think, was illegal as well. You know, in the English team hiring a spy, it's not normal. It's not how you usually should do these things. But by doing that, he found all this information and led to what we have now and what we know as the big FIFA scandal of 2015.
Yeah, I suppose it's less licensed to kick a ball than more licensed to kick ass. You know, I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, I'm old enough to be, I mean, cynical about these things, you know. I think people would be more surprised if FIFA delegates weren't bribed than if they were bribed. You know, it's a terrible situation to suggest it might be true, but I think it probably is true that people would be surprised if people weren't bribed, because FIFA has such a terrible reputation, you know, to the average guy in the streets. You know, I mean, it's just like the accepted norm. Okay, FIFA is corrupt. Well, yeah. You know, and it's going to rain tomorrow, and what else? You know, it's a terrible thing, but yeah. I just want to look at a couple of the games that that went on in the tournament. One of the teams that qualified was Iran, and there was obviously an issue in domestic Iranian football where women aren't allowed to sort of go into stadiums to watch the tournament. So it's interesting how the Russians dealt with that one, Matthew.
Yeah, that's an interesting case because so since the 1970 Iranian Revolution, women have not been allowed into stadiums. It's not law, but it's treated as such, and it's treated with impunity. And it all sort of led to, I'm sure you guys remember Blue Girl, the poor woman in Iran, Sahar Khodiari, who set herself on fire because she regularly attended stadiums using many of the disguises that women in Iran do. Like, they dress up as men, they cover themselves to hide their sex. But she was found out, and she was so scared about what the regime might do to her, she committed suicide effectively. like a really tragic story that sort of reverberated around the world. In Iran, I don't know, I guess it's like a PR stunt, but they allowed women into the stadiums for the first time because they'd had the big screens on the pitches so families could come in to watch the game. And this was a huge deal. This was enormous. This is the first time in 40, 50 years that women have seen a football pitch in this country that treats its women like second-class citizens. I mean, in Iran, women aren't able to have driving licenses. They're not allowed to have passports. Everything is in the husband's name.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of concerns, like you say, as well, about what this would mean for Iranian women traveling to Russia. And curiously, there was nothing. There was a few times when Iranian women were questioned, but those who travelled to the stadiums were pictured. There were videos of them in the stadium, and it was all fine. It was just when they got back to Iran is when it was the problem again, because after the World Cup, nothing changed. Women still weren't allowed into the stadiums.
Yeah, I know you spent a lot of time in Madrid, and the Spanish Super Cup pre-season tournament was staged in Saudi Arabia, and there was a big thing. I think it was publicized that many women can mix in the stadium and women can allow to go and watch the games there. But a lot of reports afterwards said, you know, that was just a little window dressing for that tournament, and afterwards more normal rules applied, shall we say. I guess it's probably a sort of a mirror image of the issue with Iran and women going to football there.
Exactly. I know. Yeah. There was a case, because I've written about this in the past. I'm going to get the dates wrong, but in 2019, after what happened with Sahar Kodiari, women were eventually allowed into stadiums, but it wasn't what you expected. They weren't just allowed into stadiums. They were like caged in a part of the stadium in Tehran, in a 90,000 seater stadium. I think 4,000 or 5,000 women were allowed in, and then they were kept behind armed guards and effectively caged in the corner. It wasn't a win by any stretch of the imagination. It was still incredibly depressing to see.
Stu?
Yeah, and you see, this is now where I get on my soapbox, because, you know, FIFA's slogan is for the good of the game. Now, to me, FIFA are custodians of the game of football. They're there to look after it, protect it, make sure it's available to as many people as possible around the globe, you know. They're there to promote the game and look after it. And here, you know, here are these opportunities whereby, I'm not saying they can go into Iran and make demands, but they can certainly apply. You know, if FIFA is as powerful as FIFA likes to think is, and, you know, there's a quote from Havelange who talks about being able to walk in a room with kings and presidents and be their equal. Now, if you're trying to promote that sort of power and that sort of gravitas, then surely you also have the potential, or your organization has the potential, to make noises for good. You know, looking at this with regards to, you know, Iranian females, for example, being allowed into stadiums and to games. Now, whether that's through withholding funds for Iranian football, I don't know. But this is, to me, where FIFA should be making noises. FIFA should be sort of, you know, not interfering, but FIFA should be sort of looking to their member states to maybe make changes. You know, they should be asking the questions of politicians and asking the questions, certainly where it becomes football related. And yet it seems, again, to do very little towards this sort of situation.
Exactly. It makes you look at FIFA and say, what are you for? What do you do? What do they do? I struggle to proper formulate my thoughts on this, because I totally agree. I think they are so clearly an operation and an organization that exists to make money. They twisted and contorted what, you know, the innocent game that you love as a child. It's not that anymore, and they're not a force for good. That's why I call them cartoonish, because it's like you say, if this wasn't real life, it would make for an amazing story, because this is just, it's baffling. And exactly.
You can join me on my soapbox if you want, Matt.
there's
plenty of room up here, don't worry.
I just want to run a couple of things past you. And Tom's running away with us, it always does. But we don't care for a bit, because, you know, we don't care.
We don't.
Just, So, I mean, there was a one of the games and the controversy about the game, and then one of the players. So, there was an instance in the Switzerland Serbia game, between Switzerland and Serbia, and also about Paulo Guerrero, Peru. So, can you tell us a little bit about the political aspects of that, mate?
Yeah, of course. I'll start with Switzerland and Serbia. So this was one of the more fiery elements of the World Cup. When Switzerland beat Serbia in the group stage, the two scorers, Granit Xhaka and Jerdan Shaqiri, both celebrated by making eagle gestures with their hands. And this is linked to both of these players are of Kosovan descent, but raised in Switzerland. Xhaka's father, for example, was imprisoned and beaten in former Yugoslav camps for campaigning in favour of Kosovan independence. And Xhaka's brother also plays for Albania. For his part, Xhaka said that his celebration was not an act of provocation. It was for my people who always supported me, he said. For those who did not neglect me in my homeland where my parents' roots are. These were pure emotions. But for the Serbians, this was seen as like an anti-Serbian sentiment, an act of provocation. And this is because Kosovo is obviously the former Serbian province that declared independence in 2008. And Serbia still to this day doesn't recognise Kosovo's independence, and the relations between the two countries are fraught, to say the least. To sort of exacerbate the situation as well, Swiss players were booed and whistled by the Russian crowd, and there were lots of chants of Serbia, Russia, Serbia, Russia, and a big banner declaring that Serbia and Russia were brothers. And it was something that rumbled on during the tournament. There was a lot of back and forth between players of Kosovan descent and Serbian players. Eventually, FIFA got involved, charging Shaqiri and Xhaka for the what they called political gestures.
Yeah. What about Guerrero, Matthew?
So this is one of the more fun aspects of the story of the story of the World Cup, I guess. So Paulo Guerrero is an iconic striker for Peru, widely regarded as one of the best players over the last few decades. It also involves Cass, who are in the news now because of what's happening with Manchester City. So it began with Guerrero failing a doping test. Cocaine was found in his system. He was handed a ban, but he always declared his innocence, saying that he never used cocaine. And the traces of, I'm going to say this wrong now, benzolecogonine, which is the substance found in his urine, came from the consumption of cocoa leaves, which is very common in Peru. And he was saved and allowed to play at the tournament from one of the most unusual sources, mummies. So this goes back to 1999 when frozen bodies of three Inca children were found on top of a volcano between Chile and Argentina. A Brazilian biochemist conducted some experiments on these 500-year-old mummies and found the same substance, the benzoylecogonine, in their hair. This was used as evidence to say, look, Guerrero's innocent. This comes from the cocoa leaves he consumes. Cass, the Court of Arbitration of Sport, said no and actually increased his ban up to 14 months. Guerrero and Peru escalated it to the only place it can go after Cass, the Swiss Federal Tribunal, who tested the mummies again and with the same outcome. The ban was temporarily lifted and he was allowed to participate. I think this is one of the more sort of surreal stories of the World Cup.
Just a bit. Yes,
Stu? Like I say, the whole thing, it's just, there is very little, you know, having listened to Matt and sort of reflect on this tournament, there is very little that you can almost take from this tournament in terms of, you know, legitimacy. I mean, you know, you could argue that, you know, the French performance in the final is probably something that was legitimate, you know, that worthy winners of the tournament. But it just seems to be this catalogue of, you know, as Matt said, almost cartoonish behaviour from all sides at all fronts. And I suppose a question, Matt, do you think, obviously, the World Cup is well received, and it's well received here because obviously, like you said at the beginning, of England's performance and reaching the semi-finals. But if you really look at the tournament, and you know, you really look at the bidding process, the build-up, the state of the world as was, the state of FIFA, Russia's involvement in politics around the world at the time. Do you think this tournament you know, is looked on as a successful tournament when you actually really examine, you know, at face value, is it looked at as a successful tournament? And then when you really get underneath it, can it ever be seen as a successful tournament?
That's a big question. I think the unfortunate answer is that yes, it was a successful tournament, especially if you're looking at it from a Russian point of view. It went perfectly. There was almost no trouble of any kind at the tournament. You know, I remember when we saw the Russian hooligans at the Euros 2 years before, there was nothing like that. The Russia that people going to the tournament saw is not the Russia that exists every day. But for Putin and Russia, it was an unmitigated success. It was huge. It solidified them as one of the big powers of the world again. For everybody else, I don't know. I mean, I can only speak from personally, but it's definitely a World Cup that exists with a bit of an asterisk. Like, it's one that you look at and the football was amazing. There were so many great games and we could talk for hours about the football that happened there and about England's run to the semi-final. But when you look at it as a whole and look at it in terms of like the politics and the FIFA scandal, it's absurd. And it comes with an asterisk that says, this tournament should never have happened, basically.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on an issue with politics with a small p, VAR. It was the first real VAR tournament, and there was a penalty in the World Cup final. What are your thoughts on VAR with regard to the World Cup? I mean, we're not talking about, Premier League games are, I suppose, important, obviously. But this is, you know, World Cup final is the biggest game in world football. It was obviously, I mean, okay, France won comfortably in the end, but it could have been a massively decisive factor in the deciding who won the World Cup.
Yeah, I don't know if this is a bit sacrilegious of me to say, but I kind of don't have that big a problem with VAR. Like, I'm a bit ambivalent about it. Maybe it's because now, like, I'm a Man City fan and there is no VAR in the Championship, so it doesn't really affect us. But I remember during the World Cup, it's the way it started off at the beginning of the tournament, everyone was a bit iffy about VAR, and there was a few incidents in the Australia-France game, if I remember right, that were a bit, what the hell's going on? But in the end, it was actually considered a success, and everyone was, the sort of aftermath of it all was a bit unsatisfied with how it went, but largely the correct decisions were made. We eventually got to the correct decisions. And in terms of the final specifically, I don't know. I struggled to look past anything other than France were wholly convincing in the final. And regardless of the VAR incident, I think France would have found a way. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that's a bit of an unsatisfying answer because I'm kind of ambivalent about VAR.
I have to agree about, I mean, VAR, to me, I mean, nobody would advocate as being perfect, but to me, you know, anything that eliminates mistakes is a good thing. And, you know, people say it slows the game down. That's fine. That's a legitimate argument. But, you know, people say, well, it flags, you know, it's a hairline decision or it's 3 inches offside. The laws of the game do not say you're offside unless it's only 3 inches. You know, I mean... The laws of the game are the laws of the game, and if you don't like the laws of the game, change them, don't moan about them. But anyway, just VARs, I mean, is one of those contentious issues, you know, and we can do a podcast about that. But Stu.
I mean, for me, Matt, I suppose, you know, obviously having been absolutely fascinating, you know, listening to you, you know, talk about these things, and certainly opened, as always, opened my eyes to things. Especially when information is all concentrated like this. But, and again, it's something I talk about a lot and something that certainly fascinates me. In terms of legacy of this World Cup, you know, we've talked about, you know, some of the issues with regard to playing. It's the first one for VAR. It's the bidding process. It's where it was held. It was who was who was the leader of the country where it was held, the issues with FIFA. What do you think is going to be the legacy of this World Cup?
The legacy of this World Cup, there is an argument to be made that maybe this is the most important World Cup that has ever existed, largely because of the spotlight that was shone on FIFA. Because this is, I know it sounds bizarre to say, but this, more than anything, is FIFA's tournament. This existed because of what happened behind closed doors with FIFA and corruption and the bribery and the racketeering, which makes it, yeah, makes it maybe the most important tournament that ever existed as a symbol of corruption and sort of political, you know, looking the other direction, letting Russia get away with just all sorts of atrocities. So the legacy of this World Cup, I guess, is of that. It's a symbol of corruption and a symbol of what happens when the world allows an entity like FIFA to rule unchecked with impunity. And yeah, that's exactly what I think it is. The symbol of this tournament is, that legacy of this tournament is a symbol of corruption.
Okay.
We've obviously run over a little bit, but you know, it's been a fascinating conversation, so you know, I mean, that's fine. I've always wanted to close with the same sort of question, well, similar sort of question. So I'm going to throw this one at you, Matthew. So do you think that the political implications of the 2018 World Cup are more or less than they were of early World Cup tournaments, or are they just different?
I think the fallout of this World Cup is more important than anything has happened ever in terms of the relationship between politics and football, because it shows how FIFA took a game that we love, that we all love and fell in love with as an innocent child, and contorted and twisted it into something else. I think like the winners of this tournament are Putin, Russia and FIFA, regardless of what happened with half of the Exco committee being jailed or banned from football, because like we said, once you get rid of one corrupt official, another one replaces it and nothing changes. So the winners are Putin, Russia and FIFA, the losers are everybody else, because it's becoming increasingly impossible to separate the game from the politics. And like we said, nothing is going to change.
Brilliant answer. Final thoughts, Stu?
Like I say, it's part of me feels bad for enjoying it, as I thought I might the minute the words fell out of Matt's mouth at the start of the podcast. I was like, oh no, that's going to be me. I think it's great to have these things condensed into this sort of hour and 15 minutes, because it really does give food for thought, you know, and on all the episodes that we've done, you know, and this is no different. And you know, whilst normally, depending on what the podcast is about, you know, it's about going back and looking at YouTube clips and videos and moments. But this is a podcast that's made me want to go back and read, and made me want to go back and really examine, you know, with a bit keener eye, shall we say, in terms of what actually happened around the bidding process, and actually get, you know, just follow up on some of the things that Matt's talked about, which, you know, is always that, you know, it's always the sign of a good discussion when someone's told you something or informed you of something or taught you something that you actually then want to go away and learn even more about. So again, you know, all credit to Matt, and thank you very much for opening my eyes that little bit wider about the World Cup in Russia.
No, thanks for having me on. I hope it's such a complicated and convoluted story. I hope it did it justice, and I'm sure it's like, it's such a story that spans decades that I'm sure we missed something out, but no, it's been absolutely fascinating, and thanks for having me on.
That's brilliant, Matthew. And you know, we've sort of, in this World Cup series, we've done six or seven of these, and everyone's been fascinating and unique in its own sense. And this is absolutely no different. And personally, I found this one fascinating, and you know, We've sort of said, you know, oh, that one's really politically inspired, or that one is, or this one is. But I think you've just sort of moved this one to the top of the shop, matey, because some of the things you've come out with and explained to us here have been massively fascinating and as I said, revealing. And we always say, Stu and I, as we go through this series we've done of the political football, every day is a school day, and you know, is it no different? Is it, Stu?
But no, like you say, this is part. It's a very selfish reason, certainly on my part, Gary, to be involved in this podcast, because I do love learning, but it's so fascinating. It's always great to have people who you can literally ask questions. You know, it's almost like you're paying for. Although we're not paying, please don't think we're paying that. We're really not. It's almost like you're sort of given access to an expert for a set amount of time, and it's, you want to try and gain as much information, ask as many questions as you possibly can of them. because you want to sort of, like you say, learn. You know, and this has absolutely been no different. You know,
learn loads. Yeah. So massive thanks, Matthew. It's been great to talk to you about the 2018 World Cup in Russia and discuss political implications thereof. So thanks to all the listeners, and catch us next time on the Political Football Podcast, where we'll be looking at the upcoming World Cup in Qatar, which will be our final episode, he says with a tear in his eyes. of the political football, at least for the near future. And so catch us then, and we'll be discussing football and politics once more. So cheers. Bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.